Hi, this is Let's Hear It, Music of the Moment in West Michigan. I'm Kara Lawrence. This hour, I'm speaking with Daniel Hsu, one of two 2016 Gilmore Young Artists. He'll perform Friday, May 6th, in Marshall at Marshall High School Auditorium in an evening program beginning at 7:30. On Sunday, he'll be in Vicksburg at the Vicksburg Performing Arts Center. The program begins at 4 p.m. And in Kalamazoo, he'll perform Monday at 2 p.m. in Stetson Chapel. On top of the three solo recitals, he's also appearing in a concerto performance playing Beethoven's Third tonight with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. I spoke to Daniel Hsu a few weeks ago. He was visiting his brother, Andrew Hsu, who you may remember won the Gilmore Young Artist Award in 2014. Daniel, how did you find out that you were a winner of the Gilmore Young Artist Award?
I was practicing, or procrastinating practicing, technically. And I had just gone out to lunch with an old friend who's an incredible pianist, an old classmate of mine. And then I went back to practice, and I got the phone call. And then I called my brother immediately afterwards, and he was trying to hide it, and it didn't really work so well.
What do you mean he was trying to hide it?
Oh, yeah. So the whole story is, I believe Dan Gustin, the director of the festival, had called my brother and asked for my phone number. And my brother had an inkling, was guessing, basically. And so after I had gotten the call, I had called him saying, guess what happened? He's like, I have no idea. And I don't know if you know Andrew, he's not a very good liar at all.
He's pretty straightforward, yeah.
Yeah, he's not very good at that. So, I got a phone call while I was practicing. And then, of course, I went immediately back to practice and worked hard for a little bit.
Really? Seems like you'd be mostly thinking about, oh my gosh, look what just happened. Lightning strikes almost twice. Where your brother won the award, it seems like your chances of also winning would be just remote.
It was a surprise, but it was a good one. I immediately started worrying about what I was going to do for it.
Let's get a little bit of your life history here. You are the younger brother of Andrew Hsu, who was a 2014 Gilmore Young Artist, and here you are in 2016. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in California, in Fremont, California, of course, with my brother and my sister. I spent, I'd say, about 10 years. When I was 10, I moved to Philadelphia to study at the Curtis Institute of Music, and I've been here ever since. It's my eighth year at Curtis.
So they accept children as young as 10 at the Curtis Institute?
Yes. So they used to have a rule, probably a couple of years ago, they used to have a rule that it was anybody under the age of 21, but now it's anybody of any age can audition, and I believe if you play to, I guess, their standard. I don't know if that's the technically correct way of saying it. But if they like you and I think they can work with you, then it doesn't matter what age you are. You can go there and study. And if you're like I was, if you're young, then they have special arrangements with high schools and regular education. So you can do both of them at the same time.
Were you able to live with your parents or a parent while attending at this young age?
Yeah, so at this time, my brother and I had both gone into Curtis. My sister was pursuing college at Juilliard in New York. So basically all of the kids were on the other side of the country. So we had one parent with us until we sold our house in California and basically moved. My parents basically moved for me, which is, I kind of feel bad about it now.
California is a beautiful place, yes, but
yes,
but there's nothing quite like the Curtis Institute.
Yeah, you could say that. That's for sure.
Are your parents also devoted to music? Do they play or do they appreciate music?
So my It's a very well-guarded secret, but my dad used to play violin. He was very, very young, probably, I guess, up until middle school. He was very good, supposedly, or so I've heard, but he refuses to play for me and won't talk about it. But I guess not. They're not really musicians. They definitely appreciate it and understand why all three of their children are crazy enough to be chasing this art, but they appreciate it enough for that, but they're not musicians themselves. So.
I'm very curious to know if you've also pursued composition. Andrew premiered a work, I remember, in 2014 at his recital, a great kind of, the musical language was advanced. It was late 20th century. It was really interesting. Do you also write for yourself or write for other ensembles?
I do not. I do not do any writing at all, actually. I leave that to my brother, all of it to my brother. We like to joke that he took my brain before I was born. He stole it right out of me. No, I'm just kidding. But he does all of the writing. I don't do composition at all.
So you focus on performance, interpretation. Do you also, besides solo work, work with ensembles, chamber groups, orchestral playing?
Yeah, so outside of, I guess, solo and playing with an orchestra, I actually really, really enjoy chamber music. I think it's often very challenging depending on the group that you're working with. But with the right people, it's very rewarding because being able to work with others to, you know, achieve a goal or strive towards something, and also kind of the unspoken quality that always happens in chamber music where there's just a connection between you and the others. And being able to perform with the group is always, I enjoy it very much. So, Big fan of it.
What do you admire when you look at great contemporary pianists, like some people that come to mind that have played at the Gilmore include Murray Pariah, Richard Good, Ingrid Fleet, any of the Gilmore artists? You know, when you're listening to a pianist, like, what is it that you're like, oh, that's it, that you really admire when they're playing?
One thing that always comes across is, as a pianist, and I listen to a lot of music, right? Because, and I play a lot of music, and somehow when you sit down and you listen to the greats, there's always something new about what they're playing, right? There's always something that's so uniquely, that you uniquely identify with this artist, but somehow they take this piece that you've heard, you know, hundreds of times. They put their own spin on it. It's convincing. It's respectful of what's written. And you just sit there as like experiencing something new, even though you've gone through it so many times. You mentioned Pariah, and I was actually, like, a couple days ago, I was actually looking, like, reading up on him and his history, because I'd never done that. And I was listening to his Mozart concerto recordings. And it's just amazing to see how excellent his, I don't know, excellent is such a terrible word to describe his playing, but how incredible his recordings are. It's incredible.
Does it help when you really know the repertoire, when you know what the piece kind of stands for, what the composer intended, what you've worked on, and hearing another great pianist play it, does that deepen the appreciation and the experience of listening?
Yeah, I'd say for sure, if you study the work or you know it intimately, you have a better understanding of why they made the choices they make. I believe having studied the work puts you in a different perspective as if you were, other than if you were hearing it without a real knowledge of the piece.
I've noticed a lot of pianists, when they talk about recordings that influenced them, they often talk about recordings that were made you know, on cylinders and really early technology, it's that the players at the time were really closely, they were within a lifetime of some of the composers, I think. Is that something you appreciate as well?
I definitely do appreciate it. I think I was actually, I've been meaning to, this is probably not exactly who you're talking about, since he's, I don't know if he's still considered recent, not anymore, but I was going to delve deep into Horowitz's recordings, and really understand his style more. I think there's a very interesting change that's occurred in playing over the years, and a lot of people go back to older recordings to understand how it was done then as opposed to how it is now. For example, I think if you listen to a lot of older recordings, there was this sort of a technique where if I remember correctly, I could be wrong, but I believe some people call it the Russian crescendo, where someone would build and build and build to this peak in a phrase or in a piece, and then back away from it right as you're going there, right as you arrive. For example, that's one of the things that I think people used to do much more in the past, but no longer do now. I think people listen to a lot of older recordings that were close to the lifetime of the composer because they had more context of what was happening then. Probably a better understanding of the composer. Some of them probably met the composer or played for the composer. I think those are big selling points for why people go back to recording.
Sure. But I think maybe what you as an artist have to judge as an interpreter is, how do I make a touchstone with the past, but also bring the relevance of what's happening today to my performance? It's a balancing act.
It's definitely a balancing act. My personal feeling is, unless you really strongly believe what you're playing, you shouldn't be playing it. And you can hear it in, I believe you can hear it in the playing. It sounds very abstract and difficult to grasp, like not tangible, but I mean, you can hear when somebody truly believes what they're playing, and that comes from that's one half of the puzzle, right? Like putting your own mark on it. But the other half is respecting the composer, respecting the time, respecting, you know, sometimes pieces are based off writings, respecting the writings that it's associated with or the art that it's associated with. It's definitely a balancing act.
Well, let's talk specifically then about the program you've prepared for the Gilmore Keyboard Festival. As a solo artist, you are playing this recital three times. We have an opportunity to see you in Marshall, Michigan, in Vicksburg, and in Stetson Chapel in Kalamazoo on May 9th. That's a 2:00 program on Monday. I would think from a pianist perspective, hey, getting to play the same repertoire three dates, almost 3 days in a row, is kind of a treat.
Yeah, it's definitely a treat. The program, I'm really excited to be playing it so many times, and I think there's a lot of room for creativity in how these three performances can go. Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it's so often build up to a one-time performance and then on to the next thing. People really could see this three times in a row, and it is a magnificent program. You begin with Schubert impromptus from a set of pieces he published. There was four in the first set and four in the second set. Which set do these come from?
So I'm opening with the F minor impromptu. That's the first one of the second set. It's a balance between stormy and a song-like quality. The second impromptu that I'm playing right afterwards is G flat from the first set. It's the third. It's very, very popular piece. The best way to describe this piece in a word is just Schubert. Dreamy, it gives you goosebumps.
When you're playing in G flat and you're trying to play something so beautiful, are you sort of mad at Schubert for why did you choose G flat for this beautiful melody?
Actually, no. I've done some transposition work on it just for fun in my spare time. And I really think G flat fits the tone of the work. It's one of those pieces where the kind of beauty that it is just not of this world. And there are so many ways to play it, which is why it's so scary for me to play it. Some take this long and slow, just kind of walk. And then some people, you know, put some aggression on it. Some people push it. Some people, you know, play the complete opposite. So it's played in so many different ways.
When I look at the full program and I see that upcoming, we have a Liszt kind of spiritual piece, and then we have Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky. It changes my expectation of the Schubert. He can go to a classical place, but as you mentioned, the emotions that under the surface that can come to the forefront, there can be great drama in Schubert too. And so I'm expecting you to mine some of that as a preface to what is about to come on your recital. That's why I really like the way it's designed. Were you thinking along the same lines, or just like, no, I like Schubert, I'm going to start with Schubert?
Well, it is designed in a way. My goal was to play stuff that I really liked and stuff that I think I could represent at this time, as opposed to playing a cookie cutter, like, okay, I need classical work, I need new work, I need this length of a work. That's why you end up with the Liszt, which is a very interesting, not very often played piece. One variant of the program actually swapped out Pictures for the G major Schubert sonata at the end, which was in consideration for a while, but we ended up, I discussed this with my brother, which is why I say we, but why it ended up being Pictures and Exhibition to conclude the title.
Well, and I know in our emails, I use the word like operatic or grand opera here, because the scope of the music you chose really is very grand. It can take us to the highest highs and the lowest lows. Why don't you talk a little about this Liszt benediction piece? How does this title translate to English, for example?
Right. So the Liszt work is, the title is very long, it's in French, and I won't be pronouncing it because I didn't take French, and even though I wanted to, I decided not to. Anyway, but it roughly translates to the blessings of God in solitude. It's based off a French poem, I guess. The poem speaks about a man who's restless or uncertain, and he finds peace and solitude in his faith in God, and is reborn as a new man. It's very interesting if you look at Liszt's, I guess the more personal side of his life. He was reportedly very handsome and charming and all that good stuff. So it's and a lot of people speculate whether he was going through a similar period in his life, or he had a personal connection to the poem. But the piece ends up being, I think, very uncharacteristic of Liszt's work. Not particularly a show piece. I was having a master class on it, and the first thing the clinician said to me was just that from the very first note to the end of the piece, the only thing the listener should remember is that that was the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. It's an interesting departure from the standard you might grasp from seeing a Liszt work.
Liszt is one of those composers who, for me, his life story, his personality, I bring it with me to every piece I hear because he is so fascinating. And I know that he did take Catholic orders at some point later in his life. And even though he was such like a superstar and probably a megalomaniac for a while as the man who became a superstar pianist and invented so much about what we do when we go to piano recitals today, eventually was incredibly good about giving back and supporting other musicians. And there's such a scope to his life that I think of a piece like this as, you know, he'd kind of earned it. He deserved to express something other than really flashy pyrotechnics, you know?
I agree. Although I do need to speak to him eventually about this whole thing about memorizing your music in concerts. I'd like to have a word with him. Maybe a couple punches will be thrown, but...
Yeah, maybe that was a little, little excessive.
I was a little inconsiderate of everybody else.
And Mussorgsky was a big, giant alcoholic with some brilliant, brilliant ideas, right?
Sure. That's a great way of describing him. Yeah. What a piece, right?
Yeah. It's still living in our imaginations to this day. People still orchestrating it in different ways. And yeah, brilliant piece. Connected with this theme that starts at the beginning, right?
Right. So Mussorgsky had met a Russian artist / architect by the name of Victor Hartmann. I think the year was 1870, if I'm not wrong, probably 1870 sounds about right. And they became quick friends because they both shared a deep love for Russian art. But Hartmann passed away, I believe, 3 years later at the age of 39. And he was very young, and it shook Mussorgsky, I think, very deeply, because he was very good friends with him. And what ended up happening was a mutual friend of theirs opened an exhibition of Hartmann's work. And this piece, Pictures on an Exhibition, is Mussorgsky's experience going through his friend's exhibition. How the piece is structured is, there are, I believe, 10 or so individual little pieces. These pieces range from, you know, the Battle of the Unhatched Chickens, there's a witch, there's a carp being pulled by an ox, there's children playing in a garden. So it's a very wide scope of character. And that's all interspersed with these promenades, which roughly translate to walking. And that's, you know, the experience of walking through the museum and having the work of art catch your eye. And as you can hear at the end of all these connection works, kind of the very slight character of the next thing to come. A lot of people orchestrated it. I believe some popular ones are the Ravel. And it's always interesting to hear the orchestral version because it's such a colorful, vivid piece. And it's always interesting to hear other composers take on those colors and how they kind of different instruments. And then bringing it back to the piano, which is the original intention for the work. At the end, there's this very interesting triplet structure where he ends up repeating a lot of the notes that you're already playing loudly. So what you end up getting is just this insane duplication of sound. And it's been interpreted in many different ways. I think it was Pletnev who had a fascinating recording in where he made the entire end of this work basically this one massive harmony or one massive combination of harmonies, as opposed to traditionally, I think in Liszt, if you get to a climax, you know, there's some bass and then a melody somewhere, but this is just this massive sound that occurs at the end.
It'll bring the house down is what it'll do.
Hopefully in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Daniel, thanks so much for being so so generous with your time and game to talk about the intricacies of the music you're playing. Finally, I do want a little more. I'd like you to reveal a little something more about your relationship with your brother and or your sister. And could you see yourself working with them somehow in your musical career? I mean, you're just starting, so there's a lot that could spin out in the years to come.
Right, of course. I'm very close with both of my siblings. We grew up, we were homeschooled, so we grew up very, very, very close together. And even as we are growing up and they both moved to New York and there's a distance, I'd say we're still a very tight-knit group of siblings. I collaborate with my brother and my sister all the time. We play things for each other. We play duets, duos. I believe Andrew may be writing a work for me. I don't know the specifics. I believe it was a choral type work. He hasn't given me the details yet. The only thing I've asked him is to not break my soul as I learn it. That's the only requirement I've asked of him. But he is writing a work for me. And as a brother, of course, I say, you know, I enjoy his music. But as a musician on my own, I actually do love and respect his music for what it is. And it's just really nice that he's my brother and I can ask him to write stuff for me whenever I want. Actually, I'm not sure how he feels about that. But yeah. I'd like to think that I can.
That just makes me feel great. I'm really glad to hear that you're not only siblings, but you can share this sometimes hard to put into words love of and understanding of music. It's a great connection you have, and I really hope that, you know, all of us out here get to benefit from that for years and years to come. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.